This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Chinese health officials said Sunday that the number of new cases of the coronavirus slowed for the third consecutive day. The health commission confirmed more than 1,800 new cases, representing a drop from higher numbers of new cases in recent days. Over the previous two, China had reported more than 7,500 new infections. The death toll from the virus in mainland China hit 1,665, with 142 deaths reported Sunday. The National Health Commission spokesman, Mi Feng, said Sunday that the percentage of severe cases was dropping and that the trend showed that China was succeeding in controlling the outbreak. Each country affected continues to coordinate with Asian health officials on how to take up the care of their citizens while they're abroad. VOA's Slatis Ahok briefs us on one situation in Japan.
At least 46 American citizens tested positive for coronavirus on the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which has been docked in Japan's Yokohama port since February 5th, with hundreds of infected passengers. The American travelers will have to be treated in Japan before they can return home. Chinese officials said Sunday that more than 9,500 people were cured and discharged from hospitals, and that a number of critically ill people has dropped in February. Zlatis Ahok, VOA News, Washington.
According to a coalition spokesman, there were no injuries after several rockets struck a base in Iraq's capital that hosts a U.S.-led military coalition in Baghdad's Green Zone. It's the latest in a recent string of attacks targeting coalition troops. Last month, Qasem Soleimani, Iran's most powerful general, was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad. Days later, U.S. service members were injured in an Iranian-launched missile attack on an Iraqi base. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United States and Europe appear divided over the health of the transatlantic relationship following a key security conference in Germany over the weekend, attended by hundreds of political and military leaders. Europeans accuse Washington of rejecting the idea of an international community, but the U.S. said the alliance is in good shape. As Henry Ridgewell reports from the Munich conference, there is an emergency disagreement between the Western allies over what exactly represents the biggest threat to Western democracy.
Is the West thriving or declining? For the U.S. delegation, the diagnosis was clear.
The West is winning. We are collectively winning. We're doing it together.
Proof, he said, the U.S. troops defending NATO's border with Russia and America's lead role in defeating Islamic State. Pompeo also pledged $1 billion to help Eastern European countries end their dependence on Russian gas, with the aim of boosting U.S. liquefied natural gas exports. Across the Atlantic, the diagnosis appears very different. French President Emmanuel Macron said the U.S. was undergoing a rethink of its relationship with Europe, and the continent must take charge of its own destiny. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Munich, Germany.
More than 1,000 former U.S. prosecutors and Justice Department officials called Sunday for the resignation of U.S. Attorney General William Barr after he intervened to shorten the political corruption sentence for Roger Stone, a longtime confidant of President Trump. Four career federal prosecutors, part of the Justice Department headed by Barr, had recommended that Stone be sentenced this week to up to 9 years in prison after his November conviction on 7 charges, including lying to Congress. But Barr and the top Justice Department officials expressed shock by the length of the suggested sentence, and Mr. Trump called it a miscarriage of justice. Syrian troops continue their push to retake territory from rebels and jihadist militants. VOA's Marissa Melton.
Syrian government forces on Sunday took control of several villages in the northwestern province of Idlib and the neighboring province of Aleppo in a continuing push to retake territory from rebels. Local sources reported that forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime captured several villages in Idlib province while advancing on several others in Aleppo that had been under the control of Syrian rebels for nearly 8 years. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said fierce clashes continued Sunday between Syrian government troops on one side and rebel fighters and militants on the other. The fighting comes 2 days after Syrian government forces seized control of the highway that connects the city of Damascus in the south to Aleppo in the north. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
And I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bartey in Washington. Today's Monday, February 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Equatorial Guinea's former chief justice appeals to the U.S. and the U.N. for protection.
Based on instructions given by the Minister of Security to judges, an illegal arrest order is being executed against me without due process, and I will be transferred to a high-level security prison to be tortured.
Malawi's UDF party seeks alliances during this year's court-mandated special presidential election. We have a report on Kenya police killings in 2019, and South Sudan's government appeals for international pressure after opposition leader Machar rejects government's latest peace offer.
This offer, if it is rejected, then it means that Riek and his movement are not genuine, they are not for peace in South Sudan. Because if they have rejected it, what counter-offer are they making?
Michael Makui, South Sudan's information minister, and West Africa prepares for the coronavirus. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Equatorial Guinea's former Chief Justice Juan Carlos Ondo Ngi is appealing to the U.S. government and the United Nations to protect him because without that, he says, such intervention, he will not receive a fair trial. Ngi, who is currently in hiding somewhere in the country, says his life is at risk and he will be arrested today, Monday, without due process by security forces acting on the orders of the Minister of Security. A week ago, February 11, security forces acting on the orders of President Teodoro Ngama Obiang went to Ngi's home to arrest him without a warrant. But Ngi fled his home after being warned in advance. The government has accused him of participating in an alleged attempted coup in 2017. From his hiding place, Ngi tells me that he is being persecuted because of his fight for judicial independence.
I have always called for a transition from the formal rule of law to the effective application of the constitutional precept of separation of powers and independence of the judiciary. Regarding the relationship between the judiciary and the security department, while at the funeral of my colleague, Judge Jose Sum Dongbindang, who succumbed at the police detention center, I publicly informed his family and the public opinion that the death of our missing colleague, Judge, was caused while he was under illegal detention. I therefore required Attorney General for an investigation. My action that day should suggest to our society that our nation is subject to state-sponsored injustice and violence. Precisely these views, which I expose here, are the very reasons for my prosecution and defamation today.
Mr. Chief Justice, why do you want international observers, particularly from the United Nations Human Rights Commission, to be present at the hearing of the accusations against you?
I need their protection because without their involvement, I will not have a fair trial and I could expose my life at risk. Tomorrow, February 17th, 2020, based on instructions given by the Minister of Security to judges, an illegal arrest order is being executed against me without due process, and I will be transferred to a high-level security prison to be tortured.
Why don't you challenge the accusations against you in the Equatorial Guinea courts? After all, you were Chief Justice until recently.
The courts of Equatorial Guinea are compromised now more than ever, and judges are civil servants appointed by the government and removed by the government to their convenience without any consideration of the Constitution. This is why, as Chief Justice, as I mentioned earlier, I push endlessly for the independence of the judiciary. The illegitimate accusations leveled against me are clearly acts of reprisal because of my unequivocal request for judicial reforms. It is evident from the manner in which I have been accused and treated by the security forces that I will never receive a fair trial in Equatorial Guinea. So once again, I respectfully appeal that the UN and the international community intervene on my behalf in the interests of justice and human rights.
Mr. Chief Justice, do you have political ambition?
My only ambition is to contribute to the establishment of a rule of law that guarantees fundamental rights for all citizens, to contribute to the reflection on improving rules of governance and conforming the international standards. leaving the corruption, healing business environment to bring foreign investment and provide the necessary conditions for our fellow citizens' wellness.
Mr. Chief Justice, thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, Mr. Butte.
Juan Carlos Ondo Angid is the former Chief Justice of Equatorial Guinea. He was speaking with us from his hiding place somewhere in the country. South Sudan's government is appealing to the international community to pressure opposition leader Riek Machar to accept President Salva Kiir's latest peace offer. President Kiir offered to reduce the number of states from the current 32 to 10, plus the creation of three administrative areas. But on Sunday, Riek Machar and his Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition SPLM-IO turned down this 10-state proposal, saying they do not want the creation of three administrative areas. Michael Makui, South Sudan's information minister, he says Machar wants nothing short of being president of South Sudan.
Well, it is rather surprised to see Riek Machar rejecting his own position. He's the one who demanded that we go in for 10, which is the original 10, or else we go to 23 plus or 24 plus or 25 plus. This was his position. So President Salva Kiir opted for 10. And this offer, if it is rejected, then it means that Riek and his movement are not genuine, they are not for peace in South Sudan. Because if they have rejected it, what counter-offer are they making? There is no better offer other than this.
Dr. Machar is concerned about the addition by President Salva Kiir of these three administrative areas, Pibor, Ruweng, and Abyei.
Well, of course, these two administrative areas were already there. It's only the Ruweng, which is the third administrative area, which the president added, and it is within his prerogative.
I think Riek Machar and his people said that this does not mean that they are not going to consider the formation of the transitional or unity government.
What I know is that Riek Machar and his movement are not ready for peace in South Sudan. All that they are after is to ensure that the situation continues just like that. Because Riek Machar, when he started fighting, he was not fighting for the position of first vice president, but he was fighting for the position of the president. So what he is after is only for Salva to step down for him. This is the only situation that he will accept.
In the meantime, Mr. Minister, the extension deadline is coming closer. What happens if we get there and no government has been formed?
The government will be formed. His Excellency the President will issue a presidential order appointing his vice president, and then he will continue with everything. The constitution will be tabled, has been amended to 10 states, and it will be tabled before the executive and before the parliament, and it will be passed and signed into law, after which the government will be established.
All you mean with or without the SPLM-IO?
Well, I'm sure the SPLM-IO will not object. All these are attempts to show that you are also an important person of your own. Otherwise, Riek Machar has no reason at all. And it is the duty of the international community after this to talk to Riek Machar so that he comes to the peace. The government and President Salva Kiir had been put under intensive pressure all these years until he at last accepted to come down to the position of Riek Machar. Now, Riek Machar is rejecting his own position and is going further. Instead of the region and the international community, instead of mounting any pressure on Salva Kiir, I think it is time for them to talk to Riek Machar and give him the required pressure so that he can succumb to the peace which we are yearning for.
Mr. Minister, thank you very much.
Okay, James. Same thing to you.
Michael Makui, South Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. Today's Monday, February 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. At least 107 civilians were killed by Kenyan police in 2019. According to Amnesty International, most of those killed were young men residing in informal settlements. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
According to Amnesty International, those killed were from lower-income areas. Speaking in Nairobi, Amnesty International Kenya Board Chairperson Rene Ngamau said that most of the victims were killed in what the police say was an anti-crime operation. She says the most affected month was March, which recorded the highest number of killings, and that 23 young men were killed, most of them in groups of five and seven.
Last year, the police killed 107 Kenyans, according to Missing Voices, verified data. That tells you that there's a number that we might not know about. And these were mostly young men, mostly in informal settlements. 69% of those who were killed were youth between the ages of 18 and 35. 20% were below the ages of 18 years of age. That's to say, children. 80% of those who were killed in 2019 are below the age of 35.
The report captures many stories of survivors of police killings who are still crying for justice many years after losing their loved ones. Ms. Ngamau says the government should implement the National Corona Act and the Prevention Torture Act in order for justice to prevail.
Kenyans need to speak up. Silence is killing. Together with the organizations that are aforementioned, Missing Voices, we demand the establishment of a national commission of inquiry into violations against security agents. The reparations of the over 2 billion shillings owed to victims and families of extrajudicial killings and enforced disappearances. And a public pronouncement by the Inspector General of Police and the Cabinet Secretary for Interior condemning police excesses.
Amnesty also indicates that most of these killings are high in low-income areas since the law does not apply on them and that police view the young and jobless generation as criminals. An activist who didn't want his name mentioned says the activists will ensure the victims get justice and that investigation should be carried out to see the police who are involved in the killings charged.
We'll explore the different avenues to ensure that these families get justice. In the last 3 or 4 months, we've also explored other options of speaking to the relevant committees in the National Assembly. And we also had a candid conversation with the Independent Policing Oversight Authority to institute investigation into some of these complaints. And that's what we intend to do moving forward.
According to Amnesty International, January this year, police in Kenya killed 14 young people who posed no threat to the officers and were unarmed. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
In Malawi, the United Democratic Front, UDF party, says it is ready to enter into an alliance for the coming court-mandated presidential elections later this year. The party reached the decision at its National Executive Committee meeting held Sunday, February 16. The Malawi Constitutional Court ordered new elections by July 2020 after nullifying the May 21, 2019 polls because of irregularities. The court also ordered that in order to win the presidency this time around, a candidate must obtain 50 plus 1% of the votes. UDF President Atupile Muluzi, the son of former President Bakili Muluzi, says the Constitutional Court ruling has necessitated the need for alliances.
I met the National Executive Committee today, and its advice is that any potential coalition or alliance, whether it be with the ruling DPP, should be designed in such a way that it brings about much-needed stability and unity in the country. We have seen that the country for the past 8 months has been divided. It's affecting the economy and the future progress of the country. And I think this is a guiding issue. And of course, for the UDF, we also believe that any coalition or alliance should not compromise the values and the principles of which the UDF party stands for, which includes respect for the rule of law. And that therefore means that the party will respect the Constitutional Court ruling and implement its directives.
What did you do in the previous election? Did you align with any of the parties?
In the previous election, we were very much aligned for the past 5 years to the governing Democratic Progressive Party. As you know, I was a member of the cabinet for the past 5 years. And of course, the UDF did not fare well as a result of that. But of course, that is history. And we're looking at these fresh elections with renewed optimism, because UDF is a party that has won 3 elections out of the 5 elections that we've had in the history of multi-party politics.
So is it safe to say you are considering again to align with the ruling party?
We believe that the UDF can be a force for change. The UDF can be a force for good. We would like to ensure that any alliance is in the best interest of the people of Malawi. And of course, with the current calendar of events leading up to fresh elections this year, there'll be a need to communicate in earnest to the people of Malawi in terms terms of the direction we'll be taking as a political party. But we cannot rule out the possibility of an alliance with the ruling DPP or Professor Peter Mutharika.
As you know, the ruling party and the Elections Commission have come under fire, particularly since the May 21st, 2019 election, and now the Constitutional Court ruling. Comment first on the Constitutional Court's ruling. What do you make of that?
Of course, the Constitutional Court ruling is one that is historic for Malawi. It is one which we have to embrace as a nation, because I think it has implications for the future of Malawi democracy. And what would be extremely important is how we use this opportunity to bring about renewed hope and confidence in Malawi's democracy, in Malawi's stability, in Malawi's economy.
You're very kind to speak with us, sir.
It is always my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Atupule Muluzi is president of the opposition United Democratic Front, UDF Party of Malawi. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention concluded a training earlier this month at the Pasteur Institute in Dakar, Senegal, to prepare for the potential arrival of the coronavirus in the region. Up to 10% of hospitalized cases have required mechanized ventilation, which would be a serious hurdle for health authorities in West and Central Africa, says Dr. John Nkengasong, who is director of the Africa CDC.
We hope our best strategy will be what we are calling a rapid detection and rapid containment approach, because we don't have the capacity to have those ventilators all over to support a large number of patients as what we are seeing in China. So I think we really have to build the capacity around the capabilities of early detection and early containment.
You know, 500,000 people die of malaria every year. As a health professional, a public health professional, can you maybe comment on the level of attention, both from media and authorities, that outbreaks like this get versus long-term threats to people and especially children in the region?
Absolutely. That's a very good question. I mean, Africa faces three categories of threats, disease threats. First of all, is this emergent and re-emerging infections, like the Ebola that pop up and they're almost becoming endemic in the Congo Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and then these kind of coronaviruses. They tend to lend themselves to a lot of attention because of the ability that it has for a health security and economic disruption. I think that is really an important factor to consider. If we look at what is going on in China. China has decided to inject in $170 billion to ward up the impact of this virus on the economy. I don't think Africa has that amount of money to throw around there. So it becomes not just a social problem, but it becomes an economic problem. It becomes very quickly a security problem. The second set of problems that we have are, of course, the endemic or the diseases that we're dealing with, the HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. Tuberculosis, malaria, they killed millions of people every year in Africa, mm-hmm. for sure. We have to look at our system across the board and look at ways that we can strengthen horizontal systems that will allow us not just be reacting to these outbreaks, but enable us to control the endemic diseases mm-hmm. that we're dealing with every day.
Would this be something such as healthcare workers? You know, in Sierra Leone, for example, a large percentage of nurses work on a volunteer basis. They're not paid. You know, what kind of a real effort do you think needs to be done to make sure that governments are paying attention to these healthcare workers?
That is a very important question there and a reflection. I think when you talk of strengthening a health system, workforce development is a critical component of a public health system. I think we should do that in a very deliberate fashion and know that this is the nexus between universal health coverage and health security is the ability to have capable healthcare workers that are treated appropriately.
That was Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He was speaking to Ricky Strike from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with basketball, where the Basketball African League, a partnership between the International Basketball Federation, FIBA, and the National Basketball Association, NBA, has announced the 12 club teams from 12 African countries that will compete in the league's inaugural season, which tip off on Friday, March 13th at the Dakar Arena in Dakar, Senegal. Champions from national leagues in six countries, Angola, Egypt, Morocco, Nigeria, Senegal, and Tunisia, were guaranteed representation in the inaugural Basketball African League season. The remaining six teams, which came from Algeria, Cameroon, Madagascar, Mali, Mozambique, and Rwanda, secured their participation through the Basketball League qualifying tournaments conducted by FIBA Africa across the continent in late 2019. Andres Zaglis, Secretary General of FIBA, clarifies the workings and operations of the Basketball African League.
This is a league of balance. The league allows the champions, not franchises, the champions of certain countries to have direct spots, and then allows the champions of qualifying tournaments to have their spots. So the road to BAL is open. The road to BAL is not closed, and we believe that the development of these clubs would allow good players from the African continent to develop, stay in the continent, have a professional career.
In athletics news, New York Marathon champion Jeffrey Kamawuro will skip the African Cross Country Championship in Lomé, Togo to compete at the World Half Marathon on March 29th in Poland. Another top star and Kenya's champion in cross country, Sheila Chelagat, will also be in Sevilla, Spain for the road race, opting to hand over her place to upcoming Margaret Chelimo. Kenya selected its 40-member team for the African contest as most top names skipped the event to focus on the indoor circuit and the track competition in a year that would culminate in the Olympic Games in Tokyo. Kenya Sports Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohamed insists Kenya still has what it takes to lead the world in the short and long distance races.
Today we're validating our position as world leaders. Kenya is actually the country to look at for all these cross-country races that we have. And so this is just to validate that.
In golf news, Nigeria's Andrew Ochie Odor beat Kenya's Dismas Indiza by two shots in Kampala to claim the Kintate Open Golf title at the Par 72 Uganda Golf Club course at the weekend. This was Odor's first victory in the Safari Tour, and he was excited to lead the other professionals to the top of the title. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Equatorial Guinea's former Chief Justice, Juan Carlos Ondo Angi, is appealing to the U.S. government and the United Nations to protect him because he says without such intervention, he will not receive a fair trial. Angi, who is currently in hiding somewhere in the country, says his life is at risk and he will be arrested today, Monday, without due process by security forces acting on the orders of the Minister of Security. And South Sudan's government is appealing to the international community to pressure opposition leader Riek Machar to accept President Salva Kiir's latest peace offer. That is it for this Monday, February 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
We were staying in Paris to get away from your parents, and I thought, wow.
This week, Border Crossings takes you on a musical journey around the world. Tune in February 17th at 1500 Universal, as we're going to be looking at songs inspired by different geographical locations. Barcelona, I still long to hold. Come visit the places that inspire some of your favorite tunes, only on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the complicated legacy of Daniel Arap Moi. His critics say Moi was a dictator who ruled with an iron fist. His supporters say he was a kind man who actively promoted education for all Kenyans. The legacy of Daniel Arap Moi.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.